I've been involved in the community, in the actually in the band council. I've been involved since its beginning. We started our discussions in about 1970, and in 1972 we felt we had progressed far enough in our development and our understanding of a of an organizational structure that we incorporated the Flat Bay Band Council. So I was the elected chief at the time, and was chief for a number of years. Outside of that, I worked with the provincial organization. I was one of the people who was responsible for organizing Aboriginal people throughout the province of Newfoundland, and later served as Western Vice President of the Federation of Newfoundland Indians, and went on to be President of the Federation of Newfoundland Indians. Since then, I've been back in my community and continue to participate whenever, wherever I am required to contribute to the overall strategy of the growth of our community and our people. I'm a very, very firm believer in communications, like, and so is the chief, Chief Lasaiga, who I work with very closely. She has a passion for providing information to people, making sure people have what's happened currently, and have opportunity to be able to question the actions of the band, the undertakings of the band, prior to like annual meetings which are held once a year, or elections that are held once every 4 years. These are all things that are included in the constitution of the band. However, communications is something that that is done on a weekly basis. This newsletter, for example, is a newsletter that that goes out definitely weekly, but sometimes, if necessary, as much as twice a week. And in this newsletter, people will be informed of exactly what's happening with the band council. If there's a job posting, then it's advertising this. When the job is filled, people are notified of who got the job, why they were the selected person. All of the actions of the and the activities of the band are publicized in this newsletter that goes in every member of the Flat Bay Indian Band Council's mailbox weekly. So, you know, this is a, I guess this shows the kind of passion that we both have, myself and Liz, for communications. We feel that communications is, you know, it has to be a priority in anything that you do. And it works both ways. Not only does it inform people of what the band is doing, but it's also an educational thing, because many times there are questions that come before the band or members of the band. They're brought to the attention of the chief. The chief seeks the appropriate answer, and the answer could go out into, would go out into a newsletter. This started sometime back in the mid 70s, I think it was. At that time, I was involved with the Native Association. It was then called the Native Association of Newfoundland and Labrador, just prior to the incorporation of the Federation of Newfoundland Indians. We reached an agreement with our brothers and sisters in Nova Scotia. Actually, the editor of the Mi'kmaq News was a gentleman by the name of Roy Gould from Membertou. And we negotiated an agreement with them whereby we would collect the happenings of the newsworthy items in Newfoundland, and we would have those printed into the Mi'kmaq News. That went on for a number of years and worked quite well. However, as we continued to develop and get the training and the education from our affiliation with the Mi'kmaq News, we found that it would be most appropriate to develop our own newspaper, and we did. We had a newsletter on the island of Newfoundland. It was called the Caribou at the time, and ironically, the name of the band now is the Hollybou, which is the same thing. But that was the very first circulation of news pertaining to Mi'kmaq people on the island of Newfoundland was the Caribou, and we had an editor and a number of reporters in different locations on the island of Newfoundland, where our people reside, to collect these to collect the news and to publish the publication monthly. I would assume that there'd be copies somewhere in the Hollywood office, because all of the files pertaining to the Hollywood pertaining to the Federation of Newfoundland Indians would be with the Hollywood. So I would assume that there would be copies of that paper there. I also believe, and these are one of the things that I'm involved in now. I'm doing a research project with the band here, and there may even be some copies in the in Stephenville, you know, they might, yes, in the library. That's the word I was looking for. And there's quite possibly that there would be some around there. But we're going to we're definitely going to track a copy down, and because I'm sure there has to be somewhere. Even if it's some of the people who there are people sometimes who like to collect various different things, and there may be some people within our membership who have it in the, you know, in their as their own personal property in their homes. It's just a matter of we haven't reached out to anybody, we haven't started the process of looking for it, but we will be doing it in the next short period of time. Communications, and I keep using the word communications because it's something that is of such a great significance. It's so important to the growth of any organization, and particularly to ours. And while the newsletter that I suggested earlier reaches every household in the community of Flat Bay and answers the questions to our members, putting together the radio show gave us a wider audience. And the intent of doing the radio show was certainly to reach our membership, but it was also to reach beyond our membership. We thought it would be a great communication tool to be able to reach in whatever areas that the broadcasts or podcasts could reach, and this would give people an opportunity to hear and learn about what was happening in Flat Bay. So it was, and we were very proud of the production, and we think that it achieved what we had set out to do. That is one of the highlights of any discussions that I have when outside of the community, and of course it's discussions many times even within the community, is the success that we've had over the last 30 years of our structure. We have, you know, there was, I think it was in 1972 or 73 that we had our first student graduate from high school. Apart from that, you know, everybody was... my generation and the generation before me was like grade 5, grade 6 generation. I was lucky I made it to grade 7 and then dropped out of school. And the reason for dropping out of school was because in the society that I was raised in, the culture we raised in, it was more important to go to work and help provide for food on the table, especially when you're the oldest in the family, than it was to go to school, because we never looked at school as being a career. We looked at the things that we learned as kids in our home, the way we learned to hunt, we learned to fish, we learned to cook, we learned to do everything that was needed to be done in order to survive. But education wasn't of any great significance, it wasn't of any great importance, because it wasn't something that we used. Apart from that, there was always this stigma that people that come from very, very low income society could not excel, and people who wore suits and ties and briefcases were in totally a different class than our people, and we never imagined, not alone dreamed about the fact that one of those days our kids and our grandkids could become those same people. We could produce doctors, lawyers, clergy, nurse, whatever's out there in the profession. That was something that was assumed to be beyond our reach. Well, that attitude has changed since the 70s, since the incorporation of the ban, and we've also placed education very, very high on our agenda. And the results has been fabulous. I mean, we have doctors now from Flat Bay. We have lawyers from Flat Bay. We have career people. We have nurse. We have engineers, and we have every trade that you can think of out there. We have people from this community working in that trade. You know, we have just as an example, one of the, and I'll just backtrack a little bit here. One of the things that was very, very high on the agenda of the Mi'kmaq people of Flat Bay was the services. We had people served in World War I, World War II, the Korean conflict, the Congo. So we've always had people who would join into the service because that was not something that they required a high level of academic education to do. So there was always that move towards that. We have a wealth of veterans and people who served. But over the last 30 years, we found that we have many people who have been attracted to the RCMP. And right now, as we speak, I'm aware of 11 people who are Flat Bay Band members who now are serving RCMP officers. And when you get that many people from a population of 350, that's a very, very high ratio of career people in any one particular career. You know, we have, like I said, we have two lawyers who are practicing at the present time. We know that we have one doctor that's practicing and other people who are studying. So we've certainly moved the agenda, and I was one person among many in our community who's very proud of that achievement, and we wanted to get that information out there. We also wanted to educate people, because if I may, without trying to open old wounds, prior to the 70s, Flat Bay was a community that a lot of people had very different attitudes about. My wife is not from this community. She came here in 1963 as a school teacher. And she recalls when the conductor on the passenger train checked her ticket just outside of Grand Falls and knew that she was coming to Flat Bay, his words were, get off at the next stop and go back home. You don't want to go out there among those savages. It's not a fit place for a young girl of your age to go. So and that attitude wasn't only reflected in that conversation. It had been reflected many, many times, and anybody my age in this community have heard it and felt it in our travels, not only outside of the Bay St. George area, but as far as the east coast of Newfoundland and probably even beyond that. So we wanted to erode that kind of attitude, because I don't deny that there hadn't been some incidents in our community, but the incidents in our community were the ones that were blown up, and the incidents that took place in other areas were the ones that were kept quiet. So, when I look at the news now, and almost every night there's a robbery in St. John's, I realize that the population was a lot bigger than ours, but we don't address the robberies as a culture of the people. We address it as an individual, very stupid attack, where back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, and even early 80s, and to some degree there are still people that have that attitude yet, when somebody from Flat Bay makes a mistake or gets in a bit of trouble, they address it to the culture, not to the one individual. And we wanted to erode that. Actually, I was really, really excited when I was asked, and NON had put together a very successful undertaking. And what happened at the last minute, a couple of their key people, for medical reasons, had to leave the area on the very dates that the radio show was being hosted, and they found themselves in a situation whereby at the last minute they needed some assistance. So I was asked, and Tom Rose was asked, because we have a great affiliation with the Women's Network, and are always available whenever we can do anything to assist them, because we certainly believe in the type of work that they're doing, and we see the results of the work that they're doing. So Tom and I stepped in and hosted the show, and I had nothing but great feedback from it. Everywhere I went, people talked about it and said how pleased they were, first of all, to acquire the knowledge that was provided during that day of the show, because a lot of people were aware of NON, but they weren't really aware of exactly what they were doing and what they were involved in. Also coupled with the NON information was the information about the cultural center in the St. George's area. And again, people in St. George's are very much aware of their center because it's in their community, it's theirs. But people living elsewhere, while some people have some knowledge, many other people weren't even aware of it. So again, it goes right back to this old piece of how important communications are, and communications is the key to whatever people want to achieve, and that show certainly provided that communication, and I'm like I said, I was extremely proud that I could help, and really enjoyed my day. But these are the kind of things that happen, and these are the kind of things that people feel when they're very close to something, and as an Aboriginal person, you know, we experience these kind of feelings not only in that kind of more modern type development, but we experience those same type of feelings when we're on the land, when we're in the country. Like, you know, I remember when I first start traveling the interior as a boy, when I reached a location whereby our people had been using for a campground for hundreds of years. When you get into that location, there's a couple of things that happen to you. First of all, there's almost like a shiver. There's almost like if there's a spirit that you experience, and then you have this really, you know, wonderful feeling of achievement, but you don't know what you achieve because you're only looking at trees and you're looking at rocks and maybe a little stream, a tributary leading into the main river, or it may be on the bank of the main river, and you're just in a location, but the location itself does something to you. Like there's it uplifts you. Just from being in that particular area, and I've seen many people who have experienced a more modern type, like coming into this building when there's a powwow going on or on the powwow ground, or going into the cultural center in St. George's. I've seen people experience that very same feeling. There is something attached to that environment that awakens you. Having said that. I always try to articulate any of those things by drawing a comparison so people will understand. When I first started traveling across the island of Newfoundland and found myself in St. John's for many different reasons, I found myself frequently in my younger years, when it had the first start of it, visiting George Street and these type of things. You know, going into a club and watching a band play Irish music, I would see people in there who were experiencing and feeling the same thing I felt as an Aboriginal person going into the country and living off, and not living off the land, but going on the land and visiting those sites. Whenever Irish music was presented, the people of Irish descent from the Avalon areas, they were like jubilant. They came alive. They it was something they grasped, something they, because it was theirs. It was their history. It was their culture. So there's no difference whatsoever. The only difference is we're talking about two different cultures, two different types of stimulation, but the very same thing happens. I wouldn't be truthful if I didn't suggest to you that what we've done what we're doing is that we're moving so fast is that we're losing sight of the true Mi'kmaq culture. And what we're doing is we're embracing much of what I consider to be stereotypes. And we have to be very careful of that. I think we need to slow down. I think we need to take a look at really what culture is. And while I'm a very strong supporter, because I was an advocate of the very first powwow in the community of Flat Bay, I think we need to communicate, again, going back to the importance of communication, I think we need to communicate to people that these are the embracement of jubilance and opportunities, I guess, to provide ourselves with a collection of Mi'kmaq people and non-Mi'kmaq people for the purposes of educating ourselves. But we need to be a little bit more specific on what we're using as borrowed culture. So there is a role now for the leaders of the Mi'kmaq society to play, and that's to differentiate from what is truly Mi'kmaq and what is adopted. You know, because if we circle the wagon trains and put John Wayne in the center, then that's not Indian culture. That's the stereotypes that have destroyed our culture for hundreds of years. So we have to be very careful that we don't move too far. I would not for 1 minute suggest that we discontinue these kind of activities, but I think we need to educate people as we're doing them. My perception of culture was seen in the community when I was growing up. When you passed by a person's house and you saw the heel spear hanging on the fence, you seen the dog sled turned over in the field in the summer, you seen the canoe up on a rack, you seen the snowshoes hanging on the barn, you seen a caribou hide or a cow hide that they bought from somebody in the Robinsons or Jeffreys area, you saw that hanging on the barn door, which was going to be stretched to make leggings or to make moccasins or to make more snowshoes. That's my perception of culture. Going around with a war bonnet on your head and dancing is nice, and the media grasps that. They love it, but it's not really our culture. I don't expect people to walk from Corner Brook to Flat Bay to the powwow. I know that they're going to come in their vehicles. So I've embraced the fact that we live in the 20th century, and things are going to change. You know, we're not going to advocate the burning of our lumber constructed houses and put up wigwams to live in anymore. We're not going back there. But what I do advocate is that it's very important that that on the powwow ground somewhere we do have a wigwam constructed. So we can teach our kids, we can teach them what it was like 100 years ago. Not suggest to them that that's what they have to live in now, but suggest to them that that's what their forefathers and their ancestors came through and helped to evolve to where we are now. It was, you know, because I understand and I embrace, you know, the progressive development to a certain degree. It has to happen. So the preserving of the culture and the truth of the culture has to be taught. Not only is it important that, and I talked earlier about the wigwam on the powwow ground, so young people could have an appreciation for the way of life of our ancestors and our forefathers, but the youth camp thing goes beyond that, because the youth camp thing is an area whereby we can teach survival. And in teaching survival, what we can do, and survival from a very, very broad context, you know, teaching survival is one of the things that can help in addressing our need for a greener planet. Because if we had somewhere that we could do a camp whereby we could show people how to plant, the importance of planting, the beauty of having a product that is naturally grown instead of having something that is force grown and sprayed and everything done to try to keep it until it reaches the grocery shelf, we may excite some of our young people about taking up some of gardening in their own fields, and that when they start raising their own families and that type of stuff. The same thing with the importance of hunting. If we don't teach people about the importance of hunting, we're heading for a disaster, because what's going to happen is that our children and our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren are going to become people who don't understand the importance of harvesting, not only for the subsistence and the health of our people, but also for the health of the animal that is being harvested. And, you know, we're going to have a whole group of people who's going to take the same approach to every animal as the activists and the animal rights people have taken with regard to the sealing, and has destroyed a way of life, not only for Aboriginal people, but for Newfoundlanders and many other people around the world in general. And when they're finished making money off of the seal, they're going to attack something else, because something else is going to become popular. And if we don't continue to educate our children about the importance of it and have them do it from a very, very early age, they're not going to want to pursue that way of life. And believe me, the animals are going to be in more of a dire situation, and the possibilities of becoming extinct through starvation and diseases and everything else will certainly take over. I threw out that day as a possibility, because it's a day that is celebrated by all Aboriginal people. You know, it's Aboriginal Day, but I'm not hard and fast on that particular day. But I do have a motivation for the idea of having a broader communication opportunity. I think that with the technology that we have now, it would be super to explore the possibility of having a day whereby all of the Mi'kmaq people from Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, PEI, Newfoundland, wherever, could have a radio broadcast whereby we could have people from various different locations feed into the broadcast and share our experiences, share our desires, and our common concerned on various issues, and one in particular that I did mention, because it has to be first and foremost, because that's part of our culture, is the environment, and it would be an ideal opportunity to be able to exchange ideas and start a communication on our role and responsibility as environmentalists.